WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Matthew Broderick is preparing to leave his starring role in the Broadway revival of Frank Lesser's musical, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. At the end of November, he'll be replaced by John Stamos of Full House and General Hospital fame. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Broderick recorded last spring, shortly after the opening of How to Succeed. It's his first Broadway musical, and he won a Tony Award for his performance. Broderick starred in Broadway productions of Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs and Biloxi Blues, and he starred in the films War Games, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Freshman, Glory, and The Road to Wellville. How to Succeed is a musical comedy from 1961 about ambition, office politics, and relations between the sexes. It's set in the worldwide Widget Corporation, where J. Pierpont Finch, a window washer, reads a self-help manual called How to Succeed in Business, which teaches him how to fake his way to the top. From the revival's cast recording, here's Broderick as Finch, singing the best-known song from the show, I Believe in You. Finch is singing the song to himself, brimming with confidence as he gazes approvingly at his reflection in the mirror.
You have the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and the grin of impetuous youth. I hear the sound.
You know what I really appreciated the night I saw How to Succeed? There's something very cynical about, you know, the story mm-hmm. of How to Succeed. But what really shines through everything, I thought, was your affection, and I'd have to say all of the performers' affection for the material. There was just this kind of, like, love for the material, for mm-hmm. the whole Broadway style, I thought, that seemed to go into the show.
That's
and that was just a real pleasure.
Yeah, well, we do really love it. I mean, the more you work on it, it's a just really beautifully constructed thing. I love all the songs and all the dialogue that Abe Burrows wrote. It's just very funny, and it remains funny.
Is there a different energy that you feel in a musical than you feel in a drama or a comedy? You've done dramas and comedies on Broadway
right.
before.
Well, there is a little bit. Somebody once said that, you know, the book scenes, which are, you know, the scenes that aren't songs in a musical, are really, can be thought of as part of the music also. So that there's meant to be kind of there's more of a rhythm to things. You know, whereas in a straight play or a comedy, you can sort of take your own timing. A musical seems to all, you know, people get more and more excited until they're so frantic that the only way they can express it is to sing.
Right.
So,
right.
So you have to, everything has to build up to so that these songs don't come out of nowhere. So it's a little bit more of a rigid form in a way. It's, you know, some of the Neil Simon comedies I've done are a little bit more you can let them drift in different directions, which is fun. But they don't always have these bookmarks that you have to get to, you know, these songs.
I know that during part of the time that you've been doing How to Succeed, you've also been finishing a film that you directed
right.
with a screenplay by your mother. It's called Infinity, and it's about the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman.
Right.
And I believe it about his relationship with his wife, who had tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me you have had to go back and forth from one mood to another, from one worldview, the musical comedy worldview, to a more serious,
yeah.
Perhaps tragic point of view.
Yeah, yeah, it's very strange. That movie shot literally up until the day before the first rehearsal of How to Succeed. I finished shooting and drove down to La Jolla and started rehearsal the next day. And then rehearsed and then opened in La Jolla for 5 weeks and then started editing. I was very concerned, I remember, because I was sort of trying to keep my eye on the, you know, I had to do some editing even when I was, you know, sort of by the phone when I was doing the play, and I would wake up thinking about the movie or having, you know, having had some dream or some idea for the movie, and I thought, this is really bad because I have to wake up thinking about the play now, you know. For some reason with me, a lot of ideas seem to come to me, like, as I wake up. So I was very worried, so I had to sort of figure out a way to forget the movie,
mm-hmm.
because you need that time when you're not consciously thinking about something, but that it's what's on your mind. And I don't seem to be able to do that with two things.
No, I know that you worked with your father, the late James Broderick. I think your first professional role was in a play with him?
Yeah, it was not a paying role, but it was, yeah, I did a Horton Foote play with him when I was 17, and at the HB Studio here in New York.
So he played your father?
He played my father, and we were both Southern, and I was a sort of bad son, a bad seed or whatever.
What was it like to be getting your start in playing with your father on stage?
Well, it wasn't all that easy for some reason.
I can imagine. I mean, people can't learn to drive often from their father.
No, yeah, and I tried that one too, I remember. My father tried to teach me to drive, and he would make me so angry and nervous that I remember once winding up on a grassy median between two roads, just in the middle of a field, with him, you know, yelling at me. So
you don't want this to happen on stage.
No, I remember the job was then given to my sister, and I learned very easily. But yeah, there is something about, he was a great help to me when I was, you know, when I was doing plays in high school. He would be, you know, come and watch and give me great advice. But when I was actually working with him, it was not so easy. And he would, you know, a lot of the scenes were him being mad at me. And he would yell at me with this Southern accent, and it was hard to take seriously for some reason. It just felt like Dad being a ham.
So he'd yell at you in character.
Yeah, you know, in the scene, you know, right, brother, you're not taking care of business the way you ought to, you know, whatever. And I would just think, Dad, you know, you're making a fool out of yourself or whatever. It was kind of hard. And I think my total lack of experience, too. But it was a big, you know, it was a big step. But once I did that one, the next one was all the easier.
How did show business look to you watching your father when you were a kid?
Thrilling. I loved being around the theater, and I didn't even know if I wanted to be an actor. I really kind of didn't want to be an actor, but I did think I'd like to do something in the theater, you know, like run lights or paint scenes or anything, because I just liked the atmosphere, you know, for some reason. And I loved being in the dressing room and watching him, you know, put on his makeup and stuff. Well, it was a little bit like, you know, when you're a kid and you watch your father shave.
Mm-hmm.
It had that kind of romance, you know. I thought it was great.
One of your early roles was in Torch Song Trilogy, and you were in it at the start when it was off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And you played a gay teenager who's adopted by the main character, the Harvey Feinstein.
Firestein
character. Were you advised against playing a gay role that early in your career, that everybody would assume you were gay and you'd be typecast?
I was a little bit. I had an agent who said, you know, I don't think this is advisable, you know, just because it's your first thing. And you know, he incidentally, like, was probably gay, which is also an interesting thing about the world. But anyway, I was so desperate to work. You know, I'd like to say I was brave and moral and all these things, which maybe I was, but I was also just desperate to work. And I also loved the play. I thought it was really funny and a great role. So I never occurred to me to listen to him. I just thought, no, no, no. And now I of course I think it's, you know, it's fine. I don't think people think about that risk too much anymore.
You were discovered in that play.
Yeah, no, it worked out. It was this teeny, rotten little theater, you know, and the play was over 4 hours long, and nobody was coming, and it was going to close before its run was over. And a critic, I think Mel Gusso from The Times, happened to come and wrote this rave. And that made all the other critics come, and before he knew it, we were this kind of little hit. And then we moved to, you know, they redesigned and made beautiful this theater downtown, which was right near my house, and we all moved there. And then, of course, later it went to Broadway without me, but it just was this, it was very fortunate, because when I got the job, it seemed like a kind of nothing little job, and it, once I was in it, it turned into this big deal. I might not have gotten the job if it had been known it was going to be such a thing, you know?
So did anyone assume you were gay and therefore couldn't play straight roles after seeing you in the film? In the play?
No. I mean, maybe people assumed I was gay. I don't know. But I never, I got the Neil Simon job basically from that, which was a straight teenager. I mean, that never seemed to be a problem. I would get some fan mail that assumed I was gay, I remember. But I never got offered only gay parts. And in fact, I don't even think I got offered any other gay parts.
Did you get a lot of letters? You know, dear Matthew, tell us if you're straight or gay.
I just remember one that was from a man who said, oh no, it was from who I had met backstage, and his son wrote me this long and crazy letter, which was, he didn't speak English that well, so I can't describe how strange it was, but I remember it said at some point, Matt, I am gay and my father is too. Are you as well? If not, perhaps you would enjoy my sister's sexy looks. And it had a picture of this boy and his sister standing in the Mediterranean up to their knees. And he just looked like this kind of chubby, rich boy. And next to him was this sort of scrawny, like Diane Arbus-like sister, holding a soda or something. And I thought, wow, I wonder what her life is like with a gay father and brother, and they're offering her to the straight ones. It was a very weird.
Did you write back?
No, but I kept the letter for a long time. But I don't have it anymore.
We're listening to an interview recorded last spring with Matthew Broderick. Next month, he's leaving his starring role in the Broadway revival of How to Succeed. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Matthew Broderick. I think for years in movies, you were playing younger than you were in real life.
Right.
Like in War Games and Ferris Bueller. How old were you when you made those films?
When I made War Games, I was 20, and I was playing a 17-year-old. Which is percentage is much younger. And then when I did Ferris Bueller and I was still playing in high school, 18 or something, I was like, I think I was 23. Yeah, that's right.
Were you afraid you were going to get stuck in teenage films?
Yeah, I was. I was also because Ferris Bueller was this big success, and I think that there's always a desire to for people who have a similar script or whatever to think, well, we'll have a success if we use the same formula. So you get, they lead to the same role coming over and over again, more or less. So I was a little bit afraid of that. And I sort of consciously tried to play older things, which I did, which was a bit of a struggle, because a lot of them would turn out not to be very successful or whatever. So it's been a bit of a struggle to let the parts age along with me.
I enjoyed you in The Freshman, where you're a film school student, and mm-hmm. you're studying The Godfather in class, and of course right. then meet Marlon Brando, mm-hmm. who's got something. Some Godfather-like stuff of his own happening on the side. Was it fun to work with Brando? Did his films mean a lot to you when you were coming of age?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I thought of him as the best actor in the world, and I still do. So I remember being sent that. I liked the script, too. Andy Bergman wrote it. And I said, well, who's playing? I don't remember if I... Anyway, I found out that the role was being played by Brando, and like everyone else, I was skeptical. I remember going in for a meeting with the director, writer, and a producer, and I said, "Is Brando really is this real? What, is he really going to do this? Because I don't think he'd worked in a long time. And I remember they had a wallet filled with photographs of them with Brando, you know, in Tahiti. And they would say, see, here we are shaking his hand. Here he is saying, you know, he really is coming. And I said, well, it's fantastic. So I joined right on, you know, just for the opportunity to meet him.
Is he really quirky in how he does scenes?
We rehearsed more than I would have thought. He kind of liked to rehearse a little bit. And he would work on the, he'd change some of the dialogue a little bit when he rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember him when I would act opposite him, that he was just the most lively thing in the world. He's so interesting to watch, and he's so involved in you that you have only to, you know, pay a little bit of attention to him and you'll be fine, it seemed to me. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, I remember in soccer, you know, with the good players would, if they pass you the ball, it goes right to where your feet are. So you end up having an easier time and looking better. And he seemed to me one of those actors that just makes your job much easier because he's so, he's passing you such good stuff.
I think Laurie must have been an important film for you. You played, you led an African-American regiment during the Civil War. And it's a military film. It's a film about the war, about race in America. It's an action film as well because there's a lot of war sequences. So a lot of different stuff for you.
Yeah. That was also a project that I was connected to for a long, long time. And for some reason, I don't remember, like 2 years or so before it even came on. And I loved the story, and I read all about that character. I read a lot of his letters, and I read a few books. And I also ended up getting very involved in the script.
Did you see Gloria as an opportunity to prove that you could do something different than anything you'd done before in film?
Yeah, in a kind of objective way. But really, you know, I just thought of it. I thought it was a great story. And I thought, I didn't know anything about, you know, African-Americans in the Civil War. I don't even think I knew that they fought. And they fought a lot. This is just one story. So I thought it was very important. Everybody involved in it thought it was very important that the news get out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very aware of that. And I was also very aware of the character I played, who was, you know, this Boston upper class guy, but how much his kind sacrificed and gave, you know, his family and everybody to the cause of ending slavery. So I also thought of him as a hero, and I thought that was an important thing to get out. You know, that there were some very brave, rich white people, you know, at that time who made great sacrifices.
What was shooting the war scenes like for you? They're very, you know, the chaos of battle
mm-hmm.
type of scenes.
Yeah, they were, they're chaotic, you know, by nature. Very few people were hurt. You know, I think some people, there were a couple of broken legs and bones every now and then, but nothing too serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the numbers, but I think at one point we had about 4,000, two to 4,000 extras in battle uniform with rifles, with bayonets on the end of them.
Wow.
And at night, you know, that final scene is a night charge. And there were mortars, you know, there are these explosions. So you see these little flags in the sand and you know not to run near there because that could explode. And there's also, the special effects man is watching very carefully and he knows not to set off any charge if somebody's near it. So that is safe in a way. But it's very, very, everybody's yelling and the adrenaline is flying, you know. And some of the time I was on a horse who would get sort of hysterical. So it was a challenge, but very, very exciting also. I mean, I guess that's why those reenactors like that, doing that. You know, there is something fun. Although I think they're, I should know, God, no, they're great. Never mind.
Now that you're singing on Broadway, do you want to keep singing? With a song in my heart?
Yeah, sometimes I think, wow, the next time I do a play and there's no singing, I'll feel like, gee, something's missing. I don't know. It was a lot of work, but I think I would love to do more musicals, you know, provided that somebody wants me to. There are a lot of great musicals out there. I'd love to do more,
sure.
Tell you the truth.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Matthew Broderick recorded last spring. At the end of November, he's leaving his starring role in the Broadway revival of How to Succeed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.